Hey, so what am I talking about tonight? Let's see. Ah, yes. Okay. So, the mind is set up to search for its security, its lasting sense of peace, and its sense of purpose. In external things, as we all are aware, Buddha came up with a list, 8 worldly winds. 4 of them are positive. We tend to look for our sense of security and happiness and sensual pleasures like sex and drugs and alcohol. And 2, gain. We like to accumulate money and things. 3, approval. We like to please others. We like to hear warm words from others about how wonderful we are, and, you know, the human comfort from relationships. And then 4, we also enjoy quite a bit of notoriety and fame. We want to be established and well-regarded in our line of work or endeavors. We want to have other people know that we exist. We want to have a lot of Facebook friends. We want to be highly regarded by one and all. We want to be remembered. And of course, the problem with these strategies is numerous. The first is that wherever there's pleasure, there's likely to be pain. Where there's gain, there's going to be loss. Where there's fame, there's going to be obscurity. For every party we're invited to, there will be one we won't be invited for, or many, many more. And of course, for approval, there will also be blame and disapproval. So, seeking a sense of one's, making one's sense of security and purpose and peace of mind contingent upon these endeavors is problematic. They're not satisfactory, as the Buddha put it. Even more so, if you study the way the mind works, which psychologists do. There's wonderful studies by psychologists like, Brickman, Campbell, and Easterlin, all of which pointed to this paradox that once you reach just the basic level of having your being able to shelter yourself, clothe yourself, and feed yourself, there's very, very slim returns for accumulating. The mind has an initial bump when we amass more money, and then it returns to what they call a baseline happiness level. And they found that it takes more and more and more, a logarithmic or astronomical amount, to even get a slight bump that lasts for more than a short period. And even that, eventually after a few months, returns to the same baseline level. They found, for example, that a businessman who makes $1 million, he'll have a bump for a few months of self-esteem, peace, security, then it'll return to the same baseline happiness level. The next amount that he has to earn to get that same temporary bump is something like 5 to 10 million, and then 20 million, and then exponentially onwards. And still, the bumps in happiness don't last very long. Only a few months, and then you return back to the same level anyway. So looking for security and peace of mind in these areas leads to inevitably a sense of loss and disappointment. And even worse, it distracts us from developing security, peace of mind, comfort, tranquility in the places that can, in fact, supply us with those states of mind. They are available, it's just that we spend most of our lives looking in the wrong places. And during that time, we become more and more habitually fixated on this external quest and more set up for this great sense of disappointment that people have, the midlife crises, the huge disappointments that people get down the road when they're they've been married for a long time, or they've their children move away, or their jobs eventually end, and there's this sense of I thought this was supposed to be the meaning of my life. I thought this was supposed to be the thing that brought me lasting happiness, and it's not. And it becomes very difficult the more we ingrain the search in the wrong direction to repurpose the mind or refocus it. So it's always a great idea to catch this as early as we can. Now, there's nothing wrong with appreciating sex and one's well-earned money or one's approval, but not attaching to it, which means not expecting these things to be the solution for our lives, not expecting them to be the thing that will give a sense of purpose or a sense of what this whole endeavor of life was all about. It's not going to be the thing that when we are facing our own mortality or the mortality of others will give us a sense of why we bother. So, interesting. That brings up the famous research by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the five stages of grieving and letting go, which she famously noted. The first four stages we go through are utterly, in a sense, unrewarding and distracting and purposeless and cause more stress to us than they do any good. When she did her study of people who are faced with grieving, whether it's their own mortality, they've gotten a bad diagnosis, or the loss of a loved one, there are five stages of grief. The first one is denial. It didn't happen. No, this didn't happen. We don't acknowledge. For instance, we could look at it in smaller terms, going through a breakup or getting fired from a job or having something go horribly wrong in our efforts or whatever. There is this sense of denial. It didn't happen. Just wanting to continue placing all of our efforts and our focus into this arena, even though we've had a clear indication that it's not working out. The second phase or stage was anger. The sense of it's unfair. Everybody else gets a relationship. Why not me? Lots of other people get their books published. Why can't I get my book published? You know, everybody else can buy an apartment. Why can't I buy an apartment, or why can't I buy a big car? Or why can't I, you know, have children? Or whatever it is. Of course, this everybody else is an illusion. There are millions of people who don't get any of those things. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions. But we don't see that. We just see ourselves as unique. So we live in the story of it's all about me, and then it creates anger. This is, of course, a great delusion and a great distortion. It tends to take universal experiences. Everybody experiences breakups and disappointments. Everybody experiences loss and grieving, and everybody experiences a sense of frustration when our endeavors don't reward us with lasting happiness, and yet we take it very personally, and we get angry when nobody wants to buy our albums or put out our books or watch our movies or whatever. So The third is the most frantic and desperate stage, which is bargaining. We now are beginning to get an inkling that something terribly wrong is happening in our endeavors, but or in the areas we've been placing all our faith into, or where we've been attaching to. And yet we're still desperate not to accept that the loss or the frustration or the downturn has happened. And so we'll be willing to do anything, make any deal, any bargain, when people are faced with dire prognoses. They often go and take miracle cures, no blame, but they will attempt cures that they would normally know would be utterly ineffectual. Sometimes I've heard a friend of mine who was a screenwriter who wrote a screen thing about a person who was paralyzed, I think it was, and he got a rejection. He called him back saying, well, maybe if the person wasn't paralyzed, would you be interested? It was like the whole point. Maybe if it wasn't a paralyzed man, but it was an active woman, would you be interested in it? Well, then why did you write it? That has nothing to do with what you wrote. No, we're desperate. We're desperate to keep this. Yeah, all right, I know that I'm not getting the relationship I want right now. I'll do anything. I won't look on Cupid or what are the sites? Match.com. I won't. I'll look under goodbuddhist.com. I know I'll probably meet somebody who meditates a lot and doesn't want to watch Con Air with me, but I'm desperate. Please, give me a relationship. So, and then finally, finally, the good news is finally we do come to a level of acceptance. But before that, there's depression. Another form of why me, terminal uniqueness, this is unfair. Only this depression is, the anger now is going inwards instead of outwards. We've given up. We're no longer bargaining. We're no longer trying to push it away with our anger. We're no longer trying to deny. We've now become aware that our endeavors, the areas we've been attaching to for happiness, aren't working out, and we're going to take it all personally. And it's all going to be very unfair. We wrap a lot of stories around it. Oh, everybody else gets it but me. And then eventually we get to what she showed was the positive, which was acceptance. Now, acceptance has a bad rap. The word itself actually has, from a Buddhist or a spiritual standpoint, two distinct stages to it. When we hear the word acceptance, we tend to think of something along the lines of giving up. All right, it didn't work up, I give up, I'm not going to be happy, I'm not going to get the thing I want, I'm not going to get that thing that gives me a sense of reward. It's a sense of resignation. But that's not what acceptance means. Acceptance, in fact, means that we repurpose or refocus our endeavors in a fruitful direction that can, in fact, bring us peace and purpose. So rather than being resignation or a sense of giving up, it's the exact opposite. It's a sense of hope. It's a sense of, I still can, in fact, find true meaning and happiness in my life. The first thing we have to do, the first part of happiness, acceptance, is seeing clearly what has happened. No longer wrapping it up in this sense of uniqueness or this sense of this, what Zen Buddhists call the small I, that it's all about me, that nobody else has gone through this, that the loss, that the lack of a relationship or the lack of the best apartment or a lack of achievement in one domain or area is somehow a personal insult. We let go of that and we just simply say, oh, this is what frustration is like. This is what loss is like. This is what being dumped is like. This is what, you know, being divorced is like, or this is what getting fired is like, or this is what loss is. This is what the shape of loss is. This is what it's like. There's nothing personal about it. There's nothing aimed at me about it. There's nothing, there's no shame in it. This is just what it is. And look at it. See it. We look at how the body experiences it. When we lose some relationship, when we lose a friend, when we don't get what we want from a parent or a friend, we see it. Okay, this is what it's like. Everybody else experiences disappointments in other people. This is what it's like. This is what it's like to have a human birth. You're going to get this. You're going to get disappointment. This is what it feels like. We feel the feelings, and then we see how the mind wants to go back to those first four stages of attachment, that stage of anger and outrage or denial or bargaining or depression, taking it all personally. We watch how the mind wants to undo it and wants to keep going back there and keep that effort in that area that right now is closed off. It keeps wanting to dig in there. All right, I know that I'm not getting what I want here, but I'm going to go maybe at it this way. So we watch it. We watch it. We see what it's like. That's the first stage. But the second stage of acceptance is then releasing, letting go, and moving on. And that's where the real hope is. The first thing we do, and in all spiritual paths, the first part of letting go of something is finding someone that you can trust and acknowledging it out loud. This idea that we can simply let go of something intellectually doesn't work out. Because all attachment is emotional. So this idea that it's an intellectual thing, oh, well, I see, maybe, you know, finally, yeah, I'm not going to try to get that love and unconditional approval from my mother or my friend or whatever, or my loved one or whatever, or I'm not going to try to make this work. We tend to think, maybe, all right, I'm smart, I can let it go intellectually. It doesn't work. But there's a power in finding someone and acknowledging it out loud. I have been suffering. I've been in pain emotionally. It's in every spiritual practice. It's in the conferences in confessions, in Judaism. In 12-step programs, those of you that are familiar know that there are two pairs of the steps. There's always making a list, and then there's finding someone and taking an action. Acknowledging to a sponsor in a 12-step program, oh, I'm angry about this and this and this. And acknowledging it, and then having the other person say, yeah, I know what that's like. It, by saying it out loud, not only does it make it have a sense of trueness that we've been suffering, but also we see that we are not unique. Because when we share about it with someone else, and they don't freak out, and if they do freak out, find somebody else. Because they're not the right person. But you see, when you share, oh yeah, you know, I've been trying to get my sense of purpose from my job, and I've been working at my job for 13 hours a day, and it's stressing me out, and I'm not getting what I want, and every time I get a sense of purpose from it, then I wind up disappointed again. And they say, yeah, I know what that's like. I've been there too. It's no longer about you. And that makes it so much easier when it's not about you to let it go. Somehow when we think it's all about us, we cling to it because it's me. It's my drama. It's me who's not getting the relationship or the sense of purpose and work or whatever. But if somebody else nods and says, yeah, you know, I know what it's like to love somebody and have it not work out and have to refocus my endeavors elsewhere, then it's not so personal, and it's easier to let go of the clinging and the attachment. Another wonderful thing is to notice what happens, as we did when we were observing it. Just see what happens to the body and the mind every time we go back to these fruitless endeavors. You'll notice that the body gets stressed out, that the mind becomes more and more claustrophobic and small and compacted. You'll notice that the moment the urge returns to go back and try again to something that we've clearly seen isn't working out, you'll notice from the very moment that urge begins that there's a tightening and a constriction or contraction somewhere. Maybe in your stomach or your shoulders or base of your throat, but somewhere the body will tense because it's back in attachment, it's back in clinging, it's back in a war. It's so much more pleasurable. You'll find one of the techniques I've often used when I'm letting go of something is spend a day or an hour thinking about it, and then an hour or a day not thinking about it, and just noticing how much more pleasurable those periods are when I'm not thinking about the relationship or the job or the friendship or whatever. Just notice how pleasant it is to really let go of something. It's really physically relaxing to give up. The pride doesn't want us to let go. Our pride wants to win. But our pride has nothing to do with happiness. There's this great sense of happiness, and you know what? I lost. I give up. It's not working out for me in this area. I can't drink. I can't take coffee, or I can't eat that donut in the morning, or whatever. However small you want to make it. Just giving up the battle. But then there's the positive sides. The good news is that when, what are their names again? Brickman and Campbell and Easterlin did their research, they didn't find that all hope was lost. They found, just like the Buddha did, the same groups of areas that can bring lasting happiness, a sense of security, a sense of purpose, a sense of comfort for the mind. What are these areas? Well, the first area they found, and the neuroscientists have an interesting word for it, they call it flow. We Buddhists call it concentration. Call it what you will. It's that pleasure you get when you do something that you like, where the time passes and you don't even know it, when you're no longer trapped in that sense of I or your story, where you're just completely, what the philosopher Heidegger said, in care, you're in rapt attention. They found it with people who do everything from mountain biking to meditation to, you know, rock climbing to whatever. It's that radically present, radically engaged, dropping all the narratives, all the senses of where you're going, where you're coming from, who you are, what your story is, and becoming truly at one with what you're doing. Now, neuroscientists call this flow. Buddhists call this concentration, samadhi. And the more unconditional you can develop these flows or these times of flows, the better. By what I mean is, mountain climbing or rock climbing is a wonderful thing to do. Not for me. I would suck at it and die instantly. But for the rest of you, it would be a wonderful thing. And Godspeed and all that. But but it's contingent. You know, you want to do it, I think, during the daylight hours. You need to buy all this equipment. You got to be near, I would suppose, a mountain or a rock. I try to stay away from them. No. But anyway, you get the idea. The more contingent the things are that bring you, if you only get peace when you're at the gym or you're rock climbing, well, those are short-term peace. You want peace that'll be available all the time, which is why meditation is so important. It gives you the practice of developing concentration and flow without needing anything. You can do it during nighttime, daytime. You don't need any money. There's no side effects. There's no danger to it. But the more ways you have of attaining flow, the better. So it's not about giving up your biking or your exercise for meditation. It's about having it all. Squeeze as much concentration and flow, as they call it, into your life as you can. The next is mindfulness. The more you are aware of what's going on inside, the less you are attached externally. They found the more that people practice mindfulness, the more secure and peaceful they were. Which means let go of this over-fixation on everything out there. It doesn't mean totally let go of it, just rebalance the mind so that you always have at least a little bit of awareness on what's going on inside, how the breath is, or whether the stomach is tight, or whether the shoulders are tight. Keep a small level, at least, of internal awareness. The more you relax the body, relax the breath, the more at peace you'll be in your life. Acts of compassion and kindness, the psychologist Jonathan Haidt has documented over and over and over again, give birth to lasting sense of purpose, esteem, and happiness. He did this test where he gave people 10 bucks or 20, I can't remember what it was, and he told half of the people to spend it on themselves and the other half to give it away to somebody. 6 months later, the people who spent it on themselves had no bump of self-esteem, could not remember how they spent the money, had no idea where it went, and there was no positive benefits for it. On the other hand, 6 months later, the people who gave that money away still felt better about themselves, still could recall the minutiae of who they gave it to and why. So bear that in mind. Acts of compassion, generosity, and kindness do, in fact, create lasting sense of esteem. Forgiveness. Forgiveness is a wonderful tool to release the mind. We've all got those stories that we carry around of how we've been abused, mistreated, and we think that somehow we won't protect ourselves unless we keep those stories replaying in our mind. I guarantee you, you'll remember. You don't have to repeat it in your mind. If somebody has fucked with you, the next time you see them, you'll know not to trust them. You don't need to repeat the story every day. But for some reason, the mind tends to believe, oh, I got to repeat this story. I got to tell the story again. Oh, it's Wednesday. I haven't told the story again of how I was fucked over. You don't need to do that. On the other hand, forgiving, simply reflecting on a time that you acted like a shit. Big news, we all do it. Times of our lives. Forgive yourself for it, and then forgive them. The mind empties out. The less stories you carry around, the less narratives you carry around, the more peaceful your mind is, the less agitated. Appreciation of our endeavors. When you do something skillful to help someone else or yourself, when you act from compassion, reflect on it afterwards. The Buddha has 10 recollections, and he very much listed reflection on peacefulness we've attained, reflection on virtue we've done, reflection on acts of kindness and generosity, all those things he asked us to reflect on. It's not a good idea to think, oh, well, I should have done it. Let go of those shoulds. They don't encourage you to do more. They don't build up peace. They don't serve any purpose. On the other hand, if you think, you know what, I really did, I don't know, something small, held the elevator door instead of pretended I didn't see the person running to the elevator. Or whatever. Get a sense of reflection on your skillfulness. And finally, the last two, developing a sense of humor. Although the Buddha didn't list that in his recollections or reflections, the Buddha did have a sense of humor. He there's a couple of passages that are, his sense of humor is pretty fucking dry. There's that famous story of the Buddha. The Buddha walking with a novice monk, and he's just explained to the novice monk how they're not supposed to touch women. And then the Buddha sees this woman in the middle of the stream, old woman being knocked about and pushed around by the tide. She can't get across the stream, so he jumps in, carries her across, recrosses the stream, and continues walking with the novice monk, who a half hour later says to the Buddha, basically, what the fuck was all that about? You just finished telling me that I'm not supposed to touch a woman, and there you go, like lifting a woman up and carrying her across the stream. Well, you think you're something special? And the Buddha replied, well, I put her down a half an hour ago. Figure it out. The novice monk has been carrying around that story for a half an hour. But anyway, that's an idea, an example of a sense of humor. I guess you didn't find that funny. I did. All right, so maybe he's not as funny as I thought, but there are other funny passages, and most monks I've gone to and retreats have wonderful senses of humor. Finally, the relinquishing addictions and self-control has its pleasure in and of itself. You'll find that there's this old story that there's nothing as quite as pleasant as the sensation of stop knocking your head against the wall. Well, letting go of the habitual habit of looking for happiness in all the wrong places has its own sense of peace in and of itself. So those are an overview of acceptance, seeing clearly and how to let go. Hope you got something out of it. And thank you for coming to Dharma Folks. And now is your chance to ask any questions or have any shares that you like. And that's it.